The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Our first article, To Die on a Hockey Rink. 1 minute I was playing in my beer league, the next I was in the hospital. By Peter Jakubowicz. On November 7, 2022, I died. I didn't realize it at first. I began to learn what happened when, out of the depths of nowhere, a voice asked if I knew where I was. I struggled to produce my monosyllabic answer. No. The voice responded, "You're in the ICU. You had a heart attack during your hockey game last night. A player on the other team saved your life." I didn't remember going to a game last night. The last thing I remembered, I couldn't remember the last thing I remembered. I didn't even know what a heart attack felt like. I heard no more questions. There was only darkness. And my grandfather's voice singing a polka. In heaven there is no beer, that's why we drink it here. The voice modulated into something menacing, Luke Skywalker gone Joker, before I faded away. My sense of being alone in the dark stayed with me long after I realized I was in a room illuminated by artificial light. My death occurred while I played beer league hockey at the Winterhawk Skating Center in Beaverton, Oregon. My signs of life, breath, heartbeat, movement, the ability to perceive and form memories, left me. When I came back, I became fixated on the period I'd lost, what had happened to me, and where I had gone. It turned out there was more there than I bargained for. This is the forgotten story of my forgotten death. I was rushed to Legacy Emmanuel Medical Center in Portland and admitted to the ICU just after midnight. I had been unconscious when I hit the ice and remained so in the hospital. The doctors delayed emergency cardiac treatment because they thought my brain was dying and I was never coming back. The earliest notes in my medical chart were harrowing. Patient was playing ice hockey when he had sudden death. Paramedic on another team did CPR and defibrillated him. This patient is unbelievably ill and has an extremely high risk of imminent life-threatening deterioration in multiple organ systems, some of which are, in fact, showing actual signs of overt failure. My official diagnosis was ST elevation myocardial infarction, STEMI, involving the left anterior descending LAD artery. A STEMI is the kind of heart attack you don't want. Sometimes they're called massive heart attacks. I was in shock. My liver was tanking. I couldn't breathe. The doctors homed in on my nonverbal state. The word hypoxia occurred in the notes with alarming frequency. I was intubated. A nurse noted I had no advance directive or family or friends to consult about pulling the plug on me. My cardiac arrest was caused by an almost always fatal total blockage of the LAD coronary artery. But the test indicated that my brain was somehow functional. A stent was inserted by way of my groin to shore up the artery that failed. Prognosis? Very guarded. I stayed mysteriously unresponsive. General appearance, comfortable, in no distress. Improbably, almost 9 hours after I collapsed, I began to respond to commands. I remembered none of this. Some elemental part of me persisted, a trace of the thoughts that normally flowed through my pinball brain and from my vocal apparatus. The darkness in which I awoke unsettled me as much as the chasm into which I had fallen. I was roused by voices, but didn't see anyone speaking. I saw only a blackness, not the absence of light, but the absence of everything. I struggled to come back, each time willing myself to stay longer. I emerged as a head without a body from a rabbit hole where I had lost my sense of self. When my juice came back on, I felt my parts turn on separately, out of sync. I wavered between consciousness and oblivion. On the cusp, I saw familiar faces rotting before I could identify them. I was heavily sedated. The voice asked more questions that I answered to its satisfaction, and it took me off life support. My ex brought our two kids, my daughter 14 and son 15, hockey players both, to see me. I don't remember their visit. My son said that my hair stood cartoonishly on end, and that I said repeatedly that I couldn't see, and asked why the lights were off. The lights, he said, were on. Eventually, I saw tubes stuck in my chest, arms, and groin, fossils of the emergency procedures. A blur of nurses and doctors treated me. One recurring note stood out. Patient asked when he can play hockey again. I understood what had happened, but had no memories to support the narrative. Instinctively, I grabbed my phone to call my mother. Maybe she would spark some dormant memories. I stopped just before I tapped Mom and Dad. My mother, I remembered, had died 10 days before I had. A week earlier, my father briefly called to say she had passed. Crap luck and difficult times had prevented me from visiting my mother in Massachusetts during the last years of her life. A year ago, the last time I talked to her, she hadn't known who I was. I put down the phone and cried. My mother died after a succession of collapses. She was resuscitated repeatedly and left dangling until the next trip to the ICU. She rehabbed and never got better. I didn't want to end up like my mother. I wanted to go out skating heel to heel like Canadian hockey star Sidney Crosby. The doctor said my heart would be seriously, discernibly damaged. Best case, I'd need a defibrillator implanted. The darkness came back. Two more stents were inserted into my recalcitrant artery. Doctor said they would test my heart before deciding what came next, perhaps more procedures. The next day, a doctor told me my heart was now, in fact, functioning normally. No scars or irregular blood flows. She was surprised, the only doctor who didn't seem to have a prepared statement. Widowmaker. That's another name for this species of heart attack because of the low survival rate. You have a 5% chance of living if you have one outside a hospital. I was at a hockey rink in the middle of the night. By dumb luck, I was 40 feet away from an expert at saving people from widowmakers. I became obsessed with a 72-hour gap in my long-term memory and imagined what had happened. I remembered nothing of the game or the ensuing events. Then I remembered one thing. The rink taped all the games. I was morbidly thrilled. I had lived long enough to watch myself die. On the night I went home, I obtained the recording of the game and watched it on my laptop. The video is grainy. A low mechanical hum permeates the footage. Players' voices echo as if traveling through a metal tube. I can't make out most of the words. The opposing team, wearing pink, just scored. It was right at the 12:30 mark of the first period when it happened. A man skates towards center ice. Right winger, number 37 in gray, displays all my quirks and tics. I'm giddy as I watch on my laptop, a lingering effect of all the narcotics I had consumed. This poor guy, me but not me, is about to go down. He should be lining up for the face-off, but he goes off script, puts his right hand to his face shield, crumples, and proceeds into a slow-mo faceplant. He doesn't even try to break his fall. Other players look at the motionless winger and ask if he's okay. A voice pierces the sonic murk. We need a doctor. Something feels deeply wrong. I'm disassociated from the almost me, who, in most of the multiverse, doesn't survive. I can't be this winger with the broken heart. I force myself to suspend my sense of disbelief and imagine it's me, if only in a movie. My death is sudden. I'm timing this. A player on the other team, number 12 in pink, skates to me. He's checking my carotid pulse 25 seconds after my collapse. I watch this over and over. After a few minutes without oxygen, your brain is likely permanently damaged. After 10 minutes or so, you don't come back. The fire department paramedics get to me 9 minutes after I hit the ice. Number 12 does CPR. On screen, the motions look smooth, fluid. He pushes down and lets up on my chest over and over, rapidly, pivoting on his knees, skates lifting off the ice each time he compresses my rubbery sternum. A man in street clothes runs across the ice and helps with my resuscitation. I watch them place the winger onto a gurney and cart it towards the rink's exit. I see clearly for the first time a face, covered from the bridge of its nose to its chin by a bag valve mask forcing the face to breathe. The body is still, the eyes closed. The face unmistakably is mine. I'm dead. I vanish through the boards into nothing. 2 weeks after my cardiac arrest, I played hockey again, in the makeup for the game canceled because of my apparent death. A few players were concerned. No worries, I said. My doctor was fine with it. I might feel some pain in my ribs from CPR, if anything. I also carried a bottle of nitroglycerin with me everywhere. A nurse told me to do so that I'd have a pill to stick under my tongue if I felt as though I was having a heart attack. I still had no idea what a heart attack felt like, but I kept the nitro with me. Derek Brochi, a second man in the movie and a former EMT, came to talk to me. I hope they told you how rare it is for someone to survive what you did. You're a unicorn, he says. We brought you back both times. You were purple. You were gone. I'm really surprised to see you. I tried, awkwardly, to thank him. Playing hockey was the only sense of community I felt in those days. I don't have close friends, and I find it hard to make new ones. The games reawakened the joy I felt as a kid playing on ponds and rinks in obscure towns in New England and upstate New York. I wouldn't let a widowmaker get in the way of a game. I didn't feel any fear, perhaps because my memory was wiped. I chose to think it was because I was a hockey player. I went down wearing number 37, like Patrice Bergeron, the toughest player ever. Warming up, I was careful to skate over the exact spot where I'd seen myself collapse. In a 5-1 win, I scored once on a wrister from the high slot, using number 12 as a screen. After the game, I introduced myself to number 12, Steve Fisher, a paramedic for 30 years with the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and the other man in the video. I was at a loss for words. I wanted to say how grateful I was to the man who'd so quickly and masterfully gotten the oxygen flowing back to my brain. Thanks for saving my life, was the best I could manage. I changed the conversation to my new favorite subject, the events surrounding my death. It's not something that you want to remember at all, he said. CPR is brutal. We're pressing on your chest in a really hard way. There's no pussyfooting around. When you're doing CPR, you're squishing the heart between the sternum and the spine to the full extent to keep that blood flowing. That's why you're in the condition you're in now, because we kept the nutrients and the oxygen flowing to your brain. He told me my brain was probably without oxygen for 15 or 20 seconds. I was unconscious the whole time, which is highly unusual, he said, adding, I was surprised that our treatment was successful. Apparently, all the planets were lined up pretty well. Over time, I became wary of telling anyone what happened. A few people asked whether I saw a white light or some sign of grace or providence. No. I stared down the abyss, literally I felt, heard a polka, saw myself die in a movie, and was rescued by two hockey players, and I still felt the darkness, I said. It wasn't what they'd hoped to hear. People reacted strangely, hesitantly. Maybe the land of the living considered me damaged and wouldn't let me back in. I continued to pick up the phone to call my dead mother, unable to break the freakish habit. I struggled to find work and survived by doing freelance writing and editing during the day and working in a computer parts factory at night. I didn't tell anyone else about my cardiac arrest or my sojourn into oblivion. I gathered stories of cardiac survivors and the people who brought them back. I didn't find a case of anyone stone cold gone nearly as long as I was who didn't stone cold die. I was nonplussed. I was unique, a medical oddity. Why me? I hope my pinball brain was worth saving. My memories were wiped by luck, ketamine, fentanyl, midazolam, and propofol. I had passed through the pain and terror that haunted other survivors and emerged with my brain and my wicked wrister intact. But what I've realized is that watching myself die was liberating, like watching the death of my stand-in, who was later reassembled as a new version of myself. I'm still uneasy, but I'm here. I'll watch the video I kept of my game. It's my memento mori, a reminder of how unreal it is to be alive, all because of Derek Brochy and Steve Fisher. On the ice, I'm averaging 1.75 points a game this season. That was To Die on a Hockey Rink by Peter Jakubowicz. And now a second article. How much should you weigh, really? The advice has moved beyond the old BMI, body mass index, measure, by Beth Winehouse. It's the number we all want to know, the magic number on the scale that would make us look great in clothes or out of them and keep us healthy. Often we set a goal for ourselves based on a feeling or a weight we remember being happy with when we were in high school. Or maybe we consult one of the many different charts and formulas to help us calculate that number. Unfortunately, none of these methods on its own can prescribe a number that's healthy and, just as important, possible to attain and maintain. So how can you determine your best weight? It's more complicated and simpler than you think. Formulas for determining a healthy weight range can easily be found online, but none can accurately recommend a healthy weight for everyone, since formulas can't take more than a few factors, like height and weight, for example, into account. These formulas can be useful in a doctor's office as screening tools to help consider health risks, says Yoni Friedhoff, MD, Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the University of Ottawa and the founder and medical director of the Bariatric Medical Institute. But, he adds, they're not really useful at giving individuals a target weight. For decades, we've been told that body mass index, BMI, is the standard. To calculate BMI, you plug in your height and weight, and then a formula spits out a number that falls on a scale from underweight to healthy to overweight to obese based on an estimated percentage of body fat. Simple, right? Too simple. And so the latest thinking is that we need to consider more than this number. Some patients use the chart and come in saying, I want to be in the normal range, says Melanie J. M.D., Associate Professor in the Departments of Medicine and Population Health and Director of the Comprehensive Program on Obesity at NYU Grossman School of Medicine. But you can't just look at a number and say that's what you want to weigh. That's not the way the charts are supposed to be used. One problem with BMI is that the chart lists the same healthy or unhealthy weight range for men and women and for older and younger adults. It doesn't take into consideration a lot of differences among people, like muscle and bone mass, says Dr. J. It can mistakenly classify muscular athletes as overweight or obese and can miss health risks for older people or others who have lost muscle. It can't take things like existing health conditions and medications into account. The BMI chart, she explains, was intended to be one among many screening tools for doctors to use as part of an assessment of a person's health risks. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that for individuals, BMI should be considered with other factors such as blood pressure, cholesterol levels, and physical examination. More recently, some doctors have begun using the BRI, or Body Roundness Index. This formula doesn't take weight into consideration at all, just waist circumference, explains Dr. J. The thinking behind this chart is that where you accumulate fat can be even more important than how much you weigh. Excess fat around the middle can be especially problematic because the fat surrounds the abdominal organs, leading to a higher risk of heart disease and other conditions. Again, though, there are caveats. How unhealthy abdominal fat may be depends on its composition, and there are different health conditions that can affect abdominal size. I wouldn't use this chart to supply a number of what someone should weigh, says Dr. J. How are they feeling? How are they doing? What's their blood pressure, blood sugar? How well are they sleeping? All these need to be considered. Confused? It's hard not to be. For people who are already dealing with health problems like heart disease or diabetes that may be exacerbated by excess weight, doctors tend to look at percentages, not pounds. A doctor shouldn't say you should be X weight, but they might say that if you lose 5 to 10% of your body weight, you would be healthier, says Dr. J. The best weight is one that you can comfortably maintain by eating as healthy as possible and exercising. For people who can't achieve a healthy weight this way, there are new medications and surgical techniques that can help. The goal, though, probably isn't the magic number you've been fixating on. Ask yourself, could I be living a healthier lifestyle? And aspire to that, Dr. Friedhoff says. Whatever weight the body settles at and maintains when we live this way is the best weight for us. That was How Much Should You Weigh Really? By Beth Winehous. And now a third shorter article as we approach the autumn season. A Crash Course in Cranberries. Time to Put the Side Dish Front and Center by Emily Tyra. Some cooks will insist on making their own cranberry sauce, laden with plump whole berries and ingredients like honey or orange zest. Others swear solely by the stuff in a can. Americans in the latter camp consume more than 5 million gallons of jellied cranberry sauce each year, just between Thanksgiving and Christmas. While 68% of Americans say they love the taste, another 15% just love the way it jiggles. If you've ever seen a slippery cylinder of jellied cranberries wriggle out of its can, you'll recognize what Farmer's Almanac aptly describes as the satisfying whoosh plop. The man who first crammed cran into a can was New Englander Marcus L. Uran. In 1912, wanting to extend the berry's short selling season, he developed a sauce that could be preserved in big batches. He sold his jellied concoction under the name Ocean Spray Preserving Company. Later, he joined forces with two competitors to form a cooperative that today comprises more than 700 family farmers. As one of only a handful of native fruits cultivated in North America, cranberries were an important indigenous food source. Vitamin C and antioxidants, especially anthocyanins and flavanols, give the tart, tiny berries their dark crimson hue. Native American tribes from the Cape Cod Pequots to the South Jersey Lenni Lenape and farther west to the Algonquins of Wisconsin culled cranberries in the wild from low, long-running vines within bogs and marshes. Bogs are one of North America's most distinctive types of wetlands, spongy beds with thick moss, acidic waters, and peat deposits. The North American cranberry harvest kicks into high gear every autumn, with the top-producing state, Wisconsin, producing around 60% of the annual U.S. crop. Massachusetts, the second-largest producer, is home to the oldest continuously cultivated cranberry beds. Some vines are more than 150 years old. Iconic images of farmers wading in knee-high, ruby-red seas of cranberries propagate a popular myth that cranberries grow in water. In fact, they have air pockets that allow them to float. So the night before the berries are ready to harvest, growers flood the bog. The next day, they churn the water with giant water reels, or egg beaters, to shake the fruit from their vines. Then, crews wade in and corral the bobbing berries with large brooms. These cranberries are considered wet harvested and are used mostly for juice drinks and sauces. About 200 cranberries get squeezed into each can of sauce. Dry harvesting, by contrast, yields fruit that is sold fresh in the produce aisle. In this case, a mechanical picker gently combs the berries off the vines and deposits them into burlap sacks, often to await a helicopter that swoops in and airlifts the berries out of the bog. How's that for a dramatic exit? Whether you stir up your own sauce, shimmy it out of a can, or simply want a serving of tableside trivia this Thanksgiving, our all-American cranberry is the answer. That was A Crash Course in Cranberries by Emily Tyra. We have run out of time for today's episode. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.